First Samuel. First Samuel chapter 8. All right, 1 Samuel chapter 8. Got down to around verse 6 or 7 last time. And the people are now asking for a king, of course. And Samuel's not happy. And but again, the people of Israel know that Samuel's sons are not up for the spiritual job. So that played into the decision. And in verse 6, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee. We covered last time in closing the fact that, you know, there comes a time where it's one thing to persevere in prayer about something. It's sometimes worthwhile to stop and think, you know, if, you know, I've been praying for this a really long time, you know, is there some reason that the Lord's not answering the prayer because he knows that I'm better off to not have the prayer answered? Is this a no answer? Now, I'm certainly not saying that it always is and that you should be paranoid about praying for something for a long time. But, you know, where you want something, and the Lord doesn't give it, sometimes there's a reason for that. And in this case, the danger is, and you shouldn't, like I said, I'm not trying to make anybody preoccupied with, you know, kind of obsessing and fearfully on praying for a long time on something, somebody to get saved, companionship, something like that. But you should be aware that, you know, there's, and what we closed with last time were many cases where somebody did pray for a long time and they got what they wanted, but it's not what the Lord really wanted for them. And so, you know, it turned out in those cases in the end bad. So here you have Israel. They're going to get their king. But the first king they should have ever gotten was David. And so Saul's going to cause all kind of problems. And you know the story about all the stuff that Saul, where Saul led him, how he did things and all those things. And I'm, again, not trying to make you paranoid about things. I'm just trying to say, Lord says no, it's worthwhile. You know, when Dad said no, my dad meant no. And so basically you needed to shut your mouth then, because no was no. And if you didn't, you were going to have a red behind. But once in a while, you know, you should at least pray for some discretion, some discernment about whether this thing you're praying for and that you want so bad is something the Lord wants for you. Or is he being merciful to you and saying, you know, no, gently, and you're supposed to take it and go on, right? So, but you just got to be careful about praying about things and going forward, looking for a loophole to do what you want to do anyway, even though you suspect the Lord doesn't want it to go there. You know, you got to be careful with that because you can get yourself in a mess, and we talked about quite a number of things last time in closing, but and so saying, verse 7, the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. And that's really worth sitting and thinking about. The last thing we covered was there in Luke chapter 19, where the husbandmen were left behind as the master went into the far country, sent his son back, plainly Jesus Christ, to reap the profits of the harvest. And all those men in the end wound up killing Jesus Christ, saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. So Israel rejected God the Father. Then Israel turned right around and rejected God the Son. Twice. I mean, talk about 0 for 2. We will not have this man to reign over us. Twice. All right, back to verse 7. They have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. And to this hour, people kind of resent God reigning over them. And he reigns, you would have to admit, as a Christian today, with great liberty, graciousness, long-suffering, tenderness, and all those things. And yet there are some things that are pretty black and white on the edge, right? And still people just have a hard time having God reign over them. It's too bad. Verse 8, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. So that's a reference back to the end of verse 7, where they have not rejected thee, but they've rejected me. But he's telling Samuel that as they've done to me, so do they also unto thee. Now, I think you probably know where this is headed, but take, for instance, in Hebrews chapter 11, we should be reminded that sometimes we're not the most popular people in the world, and we're not the most popular church in the world. We're not the most popular segment of quote-unquote Christianity in the world. Some segments of Christianity aren't Christian anyway. With us, you know, one of the things that you have to come to grips with, and sometimes it's hard in an Eagle Brook-type society, where everything is just, it ought to be all fun and games and rock and roll and, you know, do what you want to do and stuff, that there's a reproach to be born for Jesus Christ. He left us with a stewardship. We're left as ambassadors for Christ and for God. We are strangers in this world. We're pilgrims here, and we don't belong here. And while everybody is running as fast as they can back to build a bridge back to the world, you're still called to build a wall. And so what you have to be careful about is running back and you know, making buds and making friends, because they're not your friends. And you know, if you'll contemplate your calling as an ambassador and as a steward over the mysteries of God, as a witness for Jesus Christ, you know, there's going to be some animosity that rises out of that, and rightfully so. Sometimes, you know, the reproaches of Christ is something that most quote-unquote Christians, mainstream Christians, evangelical Christians, megachurch Christians, emerging church Christians, they feel animosity more towards us than they do the world, which speaks volumes, by the way. But you should expect there to be a certain amount of reproach you-ward, not because they primarily reject you, but because they rejected him. They kill him. Now, I took you over to Hebrews 11 before I started going off there. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 26, where it says, esteeming, this is Moses, of course, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than all the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. It says there that he was at least given credit for esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. I wonder if we esteem that reproach that way. I'm not saying we should, you know, desire it. You know, it's like a drug where we want to be hated because we have our own agenda. But the fact is, if you're doing it right, they're not going to like you as a whole all that much. You could never make yourself a politician. You could never get enough votes. Not if you're doing it right. I'm not saying you're making enemies on purpose. I'm not saying you walk around with a chip on your shoulder like some people I know, and I know some people do, but I am saying that you could never get elected doing it God's way, because they hate that, and rightfully so. Now, let's keep looking here, if you don't mind. Look, if you will, to John 15. You know this verse, John 15, just a few verses here I want to run past you. John chapter 15. And just remember these promises. I know when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And we see, you know, a lot of that. None of my neighbors want to shoot me or anything like that. And I'm a pretty decent neighbor, except when Max gets out. But, you know, at the same time, I know that, you know, we sat down the other night, my wife and my anniversary was yesterday, actually. So we went to a restaurant, you know, a hibachi restaurant. And so we sat at a table, you know, we had reservations, sit down at a table with, another family, you know, three kids and the couple. And we sat at the same table and had dinner because they did all the and cooked our stuff in front of us and all that stuff. So it's cool. But, you know, and we had pleasant enough conversation with strangers. But, you know, he's guzzling beer, and you can tell with the kids and all this kind of stuff. We wouldn't get along at all in a social setting more than we have to be here and eat together to enjoy the ambiance, you know. I'm saying that there's a reproach that comes with Christ. Look in John chapter 15. What did I say? 15? John chapter 15, verse 18. Yeah. If the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. So there it is. It hated him enough to kill him. So far, it hasn't even tried to kill you. Not really, you know. But, ladies and gentlemen, you should not underrate that we're supposed to take joy in sufferings for Christ. And, you know, we've been appointed as ambassadors, as stewards, and it's an important thing. It's an important thing that you hold that as a precious privilege, because it's a privilege to be in that position, right? Look, if you will, and just a couple other places. Look in 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. Oh, on the way, go by 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Just stop by there. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And notice verse 5. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us. Now, those sufferings of Christ from verse 4. Who comforteth us. In all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which also are in any trouble, by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. Part of this thing is that it's a cycle where the Lord suffered for you and then saved you. And now you're called to suffer for Him. Not for your salvation, but He called you into a special privileged place of ambassadorship and stewardship and witness, where if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, they're not going to like you that much either. Now, I don't mean you, like I said, I'm not advocating going in with a chip on your shoulder and an attitude at all. The only attitude you need is the authority of the Bible, and that you know you have light that you wish to shine into the darkness. And men love darkness rather than light. It's that idea. It's not, you know, go knock it off. Come on, just hit me. Just touch me. Just push me. Come on. You know, picking a fight. That's not it at all. You don't need that. They killed Jesus Christ. He was never like that. But, you know, He suffered for you, and so now you're saved, and now actually you're called to suffer for Him. And part of that is reproach. Now keep going, if you will, to 1 Peter, as I got you started a minute ago. 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, and verse 13. But rejoice, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings. And that calls that, you know, you're partakers of this fiery trial from verse 12. This fiery trial is Christ's sufferings, that when His glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. And that's giving you the foreview, because you may suffer it now, and you may never be able to get elected into office, which I hope you don't, because it's a pain, I'm sure. But the fact of the matter is that there's glory ahead of us, and it's just hard for us to see the glory because it's never been revealed. That's why you have to stick with promises of the book, and the Lord's never going to let you see the glory until you see the glory. So unfortunately, we don't get the foreview. You don't get the little preview of the movie before you get there. All you have is the Bible. The Lord says, don't worry, there's plenty of glory to be had. Just make sure you do right now so you get some of it, right? And so that's our calling. Now, let's go on back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And so at the end of verse 8, so they also... so do they also unto thee. So as they treat me, they'll treat you. So they reproached Christ, they're going to reproach you that way. Samuel, you're an Old Testament prophet of God. And so as they rejected me, they ain't going to listen to you, because the reason they listened to you should have been because they wanted to hear from me. When they cease to want to hear from me, then they cease to want to hear from you. And so that's where you're at. And so that's what you have to remember sometimes with your family, and you get so upset at Thanksgiving and Christmas because they're so lost and so blind and all those things, and they're so mean and they're so malicious towards you after all these years. You just have to remember that they don't want to hear from you because they don't want to hear from God. I'm telling you, some of the reason your brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, and lost family members and lost fellow employees are mad at you is because they're under conviction. I mean, these folks here were, you know, they were under conviction. And they would wave Samuel off real fast because they didn't want to hear from God. And that's the reason that people act towards you sometimes the way they act. That's the reason they slam the door. It's the reason they act like you are invisible on a street corner, is because they despise God. They ignore God too, and so they're ignoring you. Verse 9, now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest. So what's the calling of the ambassador, the steward, the witness, after, you know, the community, the public has rejected God? Protest. Samuel was the first Protestant in the Bible. I'm just kidding about that. Okay? But he protested, and there's several other protestations in the Word of God. But the idea is that, you know, even still, so after they have rejected us, well, I mean, in the main, we haven't enjoyed a great deal of success in public witnessing, which I think that's where witnessing should happen, in public. They're not coming to us, so we got to go to them, right? And they long ago, they've gotten to the point where they long ago decided we ain't even listening. So what are we supposed to do? Oh my goodness, it doesn't work. What do we do now? Do it anyway. Protest unto them regardless. Just keep protesting. That's why I think, you know, some people underrate straight preaching, is because nothing ever happens. And sometimes it does, but seldom does anything ever happen. Nothing ever happens like it did with John Wesley. But those days are long past. We are now in the protestation stage, where they rejected God long ago. They're not interested in Jesus Christ. They ain't interested in the Bible. And it's my job just to go out and protest. Okay? So, I don't know, but it's a scriptural precept. Verse 9, now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of king that shall reign over them. So now he's going to tell them some more truth they don't want to hear, and it turns out that it's going to be right, of course. Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that ask of him a king. And he said, this shall be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariot. So he's going to confiscate your kids, going to draft them into army and service. And, you know, the levels of freedom that you've had so far, when I was your king, you know, when the Lord is your king, you always have a lot more liberty than when somebody else is your king. And when Saul became king, then they went back under a yoke of bondage. And that didn't get relieved until David's day. Go on down to verse 12. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, ear it, that is to plow it. If you've ever seen an old-fashioned plow, you know, just a single-share plow, it's a curved blade that rolls the ground. So when the ground rolls over like that, you know, just a single share, it's kind of like an ear. It's rolled over like that. So that's why it's earing the ground. But they shall, where was I? Verse 12, he will set them to ear his ground, to reap his harvest, to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be confectionaries. They're going to be cooks and to be cooks and to be bakers. So he's not putting women in the military. I'm just saying. Verse 14, and he will take your fields and your vineyards and your oliveyards, even the best of them. He's going to take the cream of the crop, and he's going to take them and confiscate them and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. Twice it mentions tenth. When that's the Old Testament tithe ideal. We still a tenth is still a good number to give to the Lord on a regular basis. Jacob. When Jacob wrestled with the angel, he swore before God that he would now give, that God was his God, and that he would now give him a tenth. Then the Bible specifies that Abraham gave to Melchizedek a tenth. And so that's the Old Testament tithe. We're not limited just to tithe, but it's still a round number, a tenth. Verse 18, and ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. You chose him, he said. Go over to 1 Samuel. He accused them several times of choosing Saul, even though they wanted a king, and God actually chose the man to do it, but he accused them of choosing him. For instance, 1 Samuel 12, verse 13, 1 Samuel 12, 13. Now therefore, behold the king whom ye have chosen. So he's still accusing them of choosing him. Verse 18 of chapter 8:18. You shall cry out in that day because of your king which he shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Now that's the other side of this thing with praying for something that you want, but God doesn't want, and you nag him and persist so long, and usually the Lord lets you know that this is not for you, but you persist so long that he says, okay, if you really want it this way. Oh, you guys don't want to go into the land? You really want me to send in 12 spies, do you? Yeah. Okay, well, when the day comes that you don't go in because you disobeyed, then I ain't listening. I'm going to send you out, and I'm going to let your carcasses fall in the wilderness. Right? So what you flirt with in the disaster is then not having the Lord looking upon you with as much mercy or tenderness when you go into a situation where you now suddenly decide that you need him. No, you asked for this. So this is what you got, right? Sowing and reaping. And so there's an awful lot of passages along this line. Look in Judges chapter 10 real quick. I'm not going to run very many of them. Judges 10. Judges chapter 10, going down to verse 14. Complaining to Israel, go and cry, he says, verse 14, unto the gods which ye have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation. What are you praying to me for? You went after them, you served them, you wanted them. I'll let you have them. Let them help you. Man, what a rotten place to be in, right? A few other places here real quick. Turn to, if you will, to Isaiah 1. Isaiah 1, this is Israel's lot. It seems like the way that they rolled. I mean, this is what they always did. Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 13. Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. New moons and the Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meetings. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hateth. They are troubled unto me. I am weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide mine eyes from you. Yea, when you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. And so, you know, they're turning and walking away from the Lord. Look down in verse 29. For they shall be ashamed of the oaks which they have desired, and ye shall be confounded for the gardens that ye have chosen. So that's part of the idea. Back to Proverbs 1 real quick. Proverbs 1. Again, not to make you paranoid about praying for something for a long time, that there's no reason for the, you know, that you can see right or wrong for you not to pray for. It's just the idea that, you know how we are. We get something in our head. We want something so bad we can just taste it. And there's every reason. If you went and got counsel, somebody would say, you know, maybe the Lord doesn't want you to have that. Right? But no, you got it. You want it so bad that you're willing to make a couple of bad decisions to make sure that the Lord blesses you with it. And then one day, along comes, a mess. And you go, man, I wish I hadn't done that. Hey, Lord, help. He says, nope. You can dig out. Right? Proverbs 1, yeah. That was in my other hand, sorry. Proverbs chapter 1. Verse 24, because I have called and you refused. Now, this is wisdom, but you can sure see God in it. I've stretched out my hand and no man regarded. You have set at naught all my counsel and would none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as a desolation and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call unto me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would none of my counsel. I mean, I tried to talk to them. I sent people to talk to them. I had a preacher standing in the pulpit saying, don't do it. And they did it anyway. And so that's the price. That's the cost. So you don't want to be on that end of the stick, right? Look at, let's just go back, I guess. Well, let's look in the New Testament just for one here. Luke chapter 13. It's a good place to maybe end the cross references on that verse. Luke chapter 13. This is still new, still true in the New Testament. 13:24. Luke 13:24. Strive to enter in at the straight gate, for many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in and shall not be able. When once the master of the house is risen up and hath shut to the door, and ye begin to stand without and to knock at the door, saying, Lord, Lord, open unto us, he shall answer and say unto you, I know you not whence you are. That's somebody watching the church disappear out of the world. And now they're knocking, saying, oh, I believe now. Well, it's a little late. The window closed, right? Okay, back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 18. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, boy, people are stubborn, aren't they? You're not, are you? Not at all. Why, you know some real knuckleheads, you know that? I mean, if they're not here in the room, then you know some real knuckleheaded Christians that cannot be told. Cannot be told what to do. They ain't listening. They're going to do it their way no matter what. I mean, no matter how much you reason, nevertheless, the people refuse to obey. Okay? And that's Israel. But, you know, that's just the way people are. And so lessons that should have been learned, they've been taught over and over that should have been learned. I'm not talking about necessarily from the pulpit either. Man, there are some guys that I know that are, I mean, they are ironheads. And the Lord's taught them lessons over and over, and they just still go through the door, you know. It's just, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. Now, Samuel didn't say as a command, don't do it. You know, the Lord's already told Samuel, well, go ahead and, you know, protest, but go ahead and let them do it. And so Samuel's not saying, we think of obey as no, and so you're supposed to stop and do it, and you're supposed to do it. Samuel wasn't saying that, but Samuel was protesting to them reasonably. He was reasoning with them. That would indicate to you that when the Lord, you know, come and let us reason together, saith the Lord, right? You know, even though there may not be a definitive command in there, you know, plugging you in the head, the fact that it's reasonable and right, you should consider that you need to obey that. So I'm saying that the act of obedience doesn't just apply to do it, don't do it. The act of obedience also applies where the Lord sits down with Cain, talks to him face to face, and tries to reason with him about this thing he's got with Abel, right? And he didn't obey. So nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, nay, but we will have a king over us. I mean, we want a king. We want a king really, really bad. Why? Verse 20. That we also may be like all the nations. There it is. Just have a tendency to just want to be like the world. I don't know what it is. Don't know why they would want to be like the nations. Don't know why they would want to be like the Egyptians. Don't know why they would want to be like the Philistines, but they did. And when you stop and think it, you know, look it around with, you know, a pair of unblinded eyes, what's going on in this world? Why in the world would you want to have a king like this? Right? But that we may also be like all the nations. They wanted a king so that they could be like the world. Now, here is the Lord. He had been their king, and they weren't satisfied with him. They wanted a king like the rest of the people had. When you were in the first or second or third grade, somebody got a yo-yo, and you had a yo-yo, but you wanted a yo-yo like he had a yo-yo. You know, in my day, in the fourth grade, it wasn't enough to have the regular little, you know, yo-yo thingy. You had to have the butterfly yo-yo so that you could do these massive tricks on it and stuff. Of course, none of us ever were able to do any tricks. We just were able to hit each other in the head with the yo-yo. But still, we had to have the special butterfly trickster yo-yo. That's the way we are. If your girlfriend gets pink flip-flops, you want pink flip-flops. You have peach flip-flops. But they're not good enough. You want pink flip-flops with shiny sparklies on it, like she has. I don't know what it is. We just want to be like the world. I've been lusting for a Keurig. It's dumb. We got a coffee pot. Makes fine coffee. I want a Keurig. I know. But once the coffee brews, you have 12 cups of coffee there sitting for waiting for you. It's for the drug addict. Verse 20. Nay, but we will have a king over us. You got to be careful about that because that's, you know, they got that prayer answered. And that's a bad prayer to get answered when God's your king. That we may be like all the nations. I want to be like the world. That our king may judge us. They want the king. They want a different judge than they've got now. The Lord is their king, but you know, his judgments are different than the Egyptians and the Philistines and the Ammonites. We want a king to judge us like the rest of the nations have them judge us. We studied a couple weeks ago how in the Word of God, one of the first times that judgment shows up, a judge shows up, he delivers the children of Israel from their bondage. Well, they would rather have a king that would keep them in bondage. They've just been told Saul's going to put them in bondage. Right? Going to steal their kids and steal their stuff and confiscate all kinds of things. They've been told that Saul's going to steal their stuff and put them in bondage. And they still want that more than they wanted the Lord who brought them out of bondage. When you look at it on those, and you know, those naked facts, it's like, what in the world is going on in people's minds? Yeah, what's going on in your mind sometimes? Same things in mine. You are fallen. I mean, you are seriously fallen. You're so fallen, you're stupid. It's true. Back to verse 20, that we also, not everybody keeps coming to church where the preacher calls them stupid, by the way. I appreciate you being here. Verse 20, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us. You know, the Lord himself didn't ever just come down and march out in front of us in all of his glory. You know, he will one day, but he didn't for them here. And so we want a king to go out and put on his kingly regalia and go out before us and lead us. We don't, you know, we're the way we're led by the Spirit. We're given a charge from a book by a king we've never seen, and we're supposed to go forth unto battle, right? So no, we want somebody that we can see to lead us. He says, they say, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. We're tired of fighting. We're tired of having to fight the battles. We want somebody to fight them for us. And that's the way we are. I mean, you see it all the time with Christianity where, you know, somebody wants to come pray a prayer and the victory's won. Well, it's usually not that simple, right? I mean, usually there's a battle. There's a battle to fight. Bryce?
Yeah, I believe it's in Numbers chapter 22, where Balaam, even though he was not exactly a good guy, didn't he prophesy, Israel shall not be numbered among the nations?
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to be
numbered among the nations, yep. Yep.
And I think today, this means something to us right now, because Israel is in the UN. I think if that prophecy comes to pass, Israel has to be kicked out of the UN.
Yeah. And you could argue that while they're technically in it, they've never been honored there either. You know, they've been the redheaded stepchild, if you don't mind me using the expression. All right, verse 21. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And I guess it's Samuel there is just playing the type of Christ, because the intercessor always goes and, you know, rehearses in the Lord's ears what's going on. Verse 22, and the Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice, make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man unto his city. And so now you're going to get introduced to Saul. And we, of course, remember Saul as, you know, a failure. And that's true. But I wish you would also just think about, you know, the fact that here he is. It's going to tell you in a second he's a young man and all those things. Here's a guy that, you know, he didn't choose this. Somebody else put him in a position where he basically had to be chosen, well, before he was ready, for sure, but also he had to be, the Lord chose him. The Lord would have chosen somebody else if that somebody else were ready yet. Instead, I mean, I don't think Saul was ever in the line, but instead he had to go for the substitute, Saul. So sometimes what you're praying for, when you're praying for something the Lord doesn't want to give you yet, you're praying for a cheap substitute. And so it's not good. Verse 9:1. Now, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, and the son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. Now, Saul is a Benjamite. It's interesting that Saul of Tarsus, Our apostle to the Gentiles, was a Benjamite as well. Putting those two Sauls side by side is kind of interesting. You know, one didn't seek his position, and yet it was given to him anyway. And then he got so obsessive about the position, he was willing to kill anybody that he thought might be against him. Okay? here is Paul, who, on the other hand, you know, he is against very much what the Lord's doing, yet he's chosen as the apostle to the Gentiles. And so there's just very interesting to put those two men side by side, realizing that both of them are Benjamites. And that, you know, Saul was kind of the start of something. He was the start of the monarchy in Israel. Paul was the start of the apostle to the Gentiles, essentially, in all effect, the church age. And so it's just kind of interesting to draw the parallels and think about that. But he is the son of a Benjamite at the end of verse 1, a mighty man of power. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and a goodly. So it's not like Saul was all bad. He's a choice young man, but apparently, I mean, if I'm gauging it right, he gets shoved into something too early. Think about being put in a position where you got two strikes against you already, you know, where you can hardly succeed. If you walk the line exactly, and a little bit later you see that he could have, a little bit later too you see the Lord said, now if you as the children of Israel, you've chosen this king, if you will do right, then the king will do right. Now that's not a Calvinistic thing, that's just the idea that, you know, you put somebody in a bad situation, and here's this Saul who starts this, you know, this part of his life with two strikes against him. He's a goodly young man, a choice young man, and a goodly. There was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. Sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't. David was a goodly person and beautiful to look. He had a beautiful to look on and all those things. And so that worked out fine. But Absalom was too. Absalom was a real looker. He was a real ladies' man. But that didn't work out. And so the goodly portion is kind of scary. Saul was a goodlier person. There was not within the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. So he's a real tall guy, probably a real big dude, six or seven maybe, something like that. Verse 3, and the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with thee, and arise, go seek the asses. That was his admonition. And so one thing you see out of all this, and we'll talk more about it maybe next time, but I mean, going and seeking the asses, the Lord's will sometimes lays in real mundane stuff. And so here the donkeys break out, and so, you know, Saul and his servant get to go chase the donkeys, go find the donkeys. And in finding the donkeys, he wound up a king. And so, you know, you can't just dismiss. You're going to work every day and paying bills, washing dishes and changing diapers. You can't dismiss that stuff. You can't dismiss, you know, just, you know, having a job you hate and, you know, just can't get along with that guy at work and that kind of thing. You just don't know what the Lord's doing. You don't know what the Lord's going to use. So in verse 4, and he passed through Mount Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they found them not when they passed through the land of Shalim, and there they were not. And he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they found them not. And when they were come to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant that was with him, come and let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses and take thought for us. He's legitimately worried. You know, he's going to wonder what in the world is going on. We didn't find the donkeys, and now he's wondering if we got lost too or got killed. Verse 6. Now this you'll see later on. This is the servant replying. And one of the things I kind of pick up out of this, and, you know, you can agree or disagree that Saul is not the sharpest spiritual knife in the drawer. I mean, you know, he's a goodly young man and tall and big and strong and all that kind of stuff and has a stately, you know, manner. But, you know, if it weren't for the servant, I don't know if he would have wound up in Samuel's presence. Notice verse 6, this is the servant's reply unto him. Behold, now there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he saith cometh surely to pass. Well, why didn't you know that, Saul? you know, you're going to be the king of Israel. It's a little disconcerting that, you know, he doesn't have the spiritual maturity yet to know what to do, you know, whether, you know, we just shouldn't just go home and turn back. You know, isn't there some other way? And let us go thither, peradventure he can show us our way that we should go. Maybe let's go to Samuel in Ramah, because he's real nearby, and let's see if he can help us out. Then said Saul to the servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there is not a present to bring to the man of God. What have we? I don't know. What have you? You're going to be the king. What have you? And the servant answered Saul again and said, behold, well, I have here at hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver. It's the servant that had the wisdom, and it's the servant that had the money. Which, like I said, it just looks like Saul's a little bit bankrupt on the decisive side, the spiritual side, you know? Verse 8, that will I give to the man of God to tell us our way. Before time, this is a parenthesis, notice. The entire verse is a parenthesis. Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he spake, come and let us go to the seer. For he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer. So they used to call these guys seers in Samuel's day. Now they're calling them prophets. But then notice verse 11, as they went up the hill, they found young maidens going out to draw water, and said unto them, is the seer here? So they're still using the old seer term. Okay, that tells you something. That teaches you something. It teaches you that the way the Lord handles words that are antiquated, like old words that we don't use anymore, like a word like seer, which they didn't use anymore, they now use the word prophet just customarily, that the Lord then turned around and still used the word seer. So when somebody says there are words in the King James Bible that are antiquated and we don't use them anymore, well, how about this, stupid? How about you learn a new word? More specifically, why don't you learn an old word and still acknowledge that God is going to use the old word? He told you what the word meant. He told you that the word seer of old times now means prophet, and people customarily use prophet, and then he goes right back and uses the word seer. So the Lord's going to, you know, if you say the King James Bible has old words in it that we don't use anymore, the answer is, so what? The Lord still uses the word, whether you use the word customarily or not. So how about this, dummy? Learn a vocabulary word. Still, it just eats me alive that, you know, when you read the Bible through, and I read a lot, so maybe your vocabulary is not, you know, like mine or whatever. Maybe you don't read well or fast or anything. So, but still, most people, if you can find 100 words in the King James Bible you don't understand the meaning of, you would be fortunate. So learn 100 stupid vocabulary words. Amen. You say, but why? Because you would do it for money. If you're a carpenter, there are specialty terms. If you're a plumber, there are specialty terms. If you're a dental hygienist, there are specialty terms. Right? I mean, people sometimes go for training for 2 or 3 days to go and get upgraded on new language, essentially, when they're breaking in new systems and stuff. You'll do it for money, but the God whom you're so faithful to in the Bible, you love so much, you just can't bring yourself to learn 100 vocabulary words? You idiot. It's true. Aaron. Yeah, there's always that. Did you notice that seer is how many syllables? And prophet is how many? I mean, I know what a prophet is, but I don't know why seer is so hard. Really, you're telling me you can't figure out what thou means? Oh, the King James Bible is all these and thous. It's awful. You don't know what thou means? You don't know what thee means? I'm going to kill thee. Do you understand what it means now? It's just so weird. It's just so stupid. Anyway, there's some people so afraid of a desk, so afraid of learning something, that they can't learn 60 new vocabulary words. It's just crazy. Back to, okay, verse 9. Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire God, thus he spake, come and let us go to the seer. For he that is now called a prophet, it was before time called a seer. Then said Saul to his servant, well said. You know, thanks for coming along, because I'd be, you know, going back home by now. come, let us go. So, yeah, good call, big boy, let's go. So they went into the city where the man of God was. And as they went up the hill to the city, they found young maidens going out to draw water. And said unto them, is the seer here? Now, the only thing I got to say with that is that over and over again, you find this scenario in the Bible. There's something about maidens going out and drawing water. There just is. I mean, Moses wound up around a water hole finding his wife, right? You have the servant of Abraham that went back to the far country, and at a well found Isaac, his wife. You have the woman at the well in John 4 who met Jesus Christ. Just over and over again, there's a couple more here if I can read my writing. Yeah, there's that. Oh, there's also Jacob and Rachel. Remember, Jacob was the one that pulled the lid off the well and was watering Rachel's flock, but he found her at a well. I don't know what it is, but there's something that over and over again in the Bible where a woman goes to a well, and it's either Jesus Christ or it's a husband that she finds there. It's just weird. Anyway, so, well, never mind. All right, verse 11. As they went up the hill to the city, they found young maidens going out to draw water, and said unto them, is the seer here? We'll stop there. Any questions or comments tonight? Yes, sir, Brother Day. Yeah. Yeah, of all things, you're an American and you want to be like Europe. It's like, all righty, let's find a songbook and sing one more before we go tonight.